Hi, it's Andy Williams of the Alpha Mirrorless Show here on the TWIP Network. You're listening to This Week in Photo.
Bandwidth for This Week in Photo is provided by the CashFly Content Delivery Network. Send your web content blazingly fast with CashFly. And now, pay as you go. Start with 2 terabytes free by going to cachefly.com and use the promo code TWIP. This episode of TWIP is brought to you by Photomatics, the easiest way to create stunning HDR photos. This episode of This Week in Photo is brought to you by the brand new TWIP School. You can check it out at school.thisweekinphoto.com. This is TWIP, episode 475. Did you, Yahoo? Is this the end of the line for the once giant internet company, Yahoo? This week, the company announced most of its core businesses were acquired by telecom giant Verizon. The price Verizon paid? Just $4.83 billion. Now, that may sound like a lot of money, but when you consider Yahoo purchased Broadcast.com for $5.7 billion, hey Mark Cuban, and Tumblr for $1.1 billion, $4.83 billion starts sounding a lot like pocket change. Now, contrast this with Yahoo's market cap back in the dot-com heyday. The company was worth well over $100 billion. In this episode, we discuss this latest page in Silicon Valley drama and what this might mean for one of Yahoo's most prized properties, Flickr. It's Monday, July 25th, 2016, and this is TWIP. Welcome back to another episode of This Week in Photo. I'm your host, Frederick Van Johnson. Today we've got Mr. Julio Shorio of julioshorio.com and Mr. Jose Rosado of The Angry Millennial, amongst other projects that he's working on. Hey guys, welcome back to the show.
How's it going?
It's going good. It is going good. I'm doggy paddling, keeping my head over water, you know, making a wave when I can, you know how it goes.
That's all you can do.
It's all you can do. Jose, what's going on with you, man?
Nothing much, man.
Angry? Are you still angry? Did you get over that?
I would like to say I've been getting better, but not really. People
I encounter more angry.
Dumb people every day. So
yeah, I know. Just don't watch the news.
Exactly.
And G, man, you got a lot of stuff going on in your world, don't you? You're doing some math over there.
I do. We're getting ready for our first baby in about 3 weeks.
Wow, yeah, congrats. Yeah,
thanks. Thanks. Bidding on assignments, shopping for a studio, all sorts of stuff, and then, you know, dominating from my evil empire here.
I love the symmetry of your little setup over there, man. That is awesome. you're like motion art right there.
The wide angleness.
Oh. It's like an album cover, no matter what you do.
Yeah, looks like a Kubrick frame, you know.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's very cool. And I'm copying you with my specs here.
Intellectual, nice.
Even though I can't rock the Grizzly Adams, I can at least rock the glasses.
So. There you go. They look good.
Yeah, cool, thank you. Yeah, I have no choice. All right, guys, let's jump into this. We got a lot of stuff to talk about today. The first story up is about Verizon buying Yahoo. Finally, somebody's buying Yahoo. It feels like this has been going on for years and years. Like, who's going to be the CEO? Are they going to get sold? Are they not going to get sold? Alibaba has a giant share. Does Alibaba care? It's just been going on. And finally, Verizon stepped up to the plate, it looks like, and wrote a check for $4.83 billion with a B for Yahoo. Jose Rosado, does this make sense? Or in other words, are they getting their money's worth for that $5 billion?
Well, I mean, they did buy only their core kind of services. So it wasn't for the entire company. Like, I think their stake in Alibaba was worth something like $30 billion. And then their Yahoo Japan was worth another like $10 billion. So, I mean, it's for sure.
But it's the core Yahoo, though. It's like the DNA. It's Yahoo's right. Advertising, content, mm-hmm. search, and mobile. I mean, mm-hmm.
For sure.
They're getting the heart, services. The lungs, the right. intestinal tract, and the brain.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So. No, for sure. And what's sad is all that is still only worth $4 billion.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, they almost got acquired, I forget who it was, like, not even 10 years ago. And it was like $50 billion, and they said
yeah.
no. Yeah. And now they're getting four.
Like some apps have gone for that much, right?
Exactly. Snapchat got sold for 20-some billion. It was almost acquired for that much.
You're right. But I mean, still, in that echelon, you know, a giant company with a campus and hundreds of employees or thousands of employees versus an app with a couple of guys in a dorm room. something's not right. Julio, was it time for this? And you know, and then what happens with Flickr? Did you see anything about Flickr in here? That's what I care about.
What's happened with Flickr?
Yeah,
not a whole lot. And I think I think Yahoo is doing pretty rad for 1998. I think it's great, but for 2016, I mean, you know, I don't know. It's like Yahoo was the big deal, and then you know, it's a big .com from the 90s. But what are they today?
Yeah,
made a lot of missteps, and it's really sad when their CEO Marissa was making like all these things where you sit there and say like, "What?" Mm-hmm. It was almost like watching Trump speak. You're like, "Did she just say that?"
Yeah. And it's one thing to make bold moves. It's one thing to make bold moves, but then there's another thing to make bold correct moves. Right? Mm-hmm. So just because it's bold doesn't mean it's a correct move.
You know? Yeah. Yeah,
I don't know. I mean, I used to work at Yahoo back in the day, and I'm really? A little sad to see. Yeah, I did. I'm a little sad to see this going down this way. I was there when Jerry Yang was there. You know, Jerry Yang and David Filo, the founders of Yahoo. Wow. And I remember my first day actually meeting Jerry Yang and like, wow, you're normal. you're another cat just like me, you know? Right. Like, so it was inspiring because I'm like, well, maybe I could do something like this one day, you know?
Yeah, because you bounced around Silicon Valley a bit, didn't you?
I did, yeah. Yahoo, Adobe, I was at AOL as well. So
look at that. Yeah. And AOL is part of that story too.
Yeah.
You know, that Verizon acquired, what, last year?
Mm-hmm.
And then now, then TechCrunch, then now Yahoo. So it's definitely... I have Verizon for my internet. I don't know why that made me think of that, but you know, like we all know, a lot of these things come under one full circle, and all of a sudden it's just like three companies own everything and everyone. So
yeah, I just wonder, are we gonna, like, does this spell the end of Yahoo? Is this the punctuation in the sentence that was Yahoo, or is this a comma? Is it a period or is it a comma? What do you think?
Does it spell the end for Verizon? I mean, I don't know. I mean, how many more of these companies can they gobble up? They're like, hey, let's buy a really important company. Let's buy AOL, like 10 plus years past its prime. Let's do this. Now, I got a better idea. Let's do the same with another company, and let's make that Yahoo. You know, I don't know. It's like going out, like being like, I want to go buy a car. I'm going to go buy a Ford Taurus.
Hey, what's wrong with the Ford Taurus? I like Fords.
Be fair, I think what he's saying is, and it just occurred to me too, it's almost like the conglomerate equivalent of buying followers. If you think about they're doing is buying users.
Yeah.
So they've said in multiple places that they want basically to get to the 2 billion user base number. And right now, I know they're at like a billion.
But
or
that's
something.
Valid. I mean, don't discount that. I mean,
no, it's valid, but
having command of a giant audience lets you move mountains, you know? And it's like in internet marketing. We all know internet marketing, the money's in the email list, right? You want a giant email list so that when you do promotions or whatever, you can tell people about it and have a bigger megaphone. You know, obviously this kind of purchase is orders of magnitude larger than our little pincy email lists, but it's still valid. You know, I don't know. I don't know if I'd pay $5 billion for a list of names.
Well, you know, to be fair, I mean, I'm sure there's technology behind the scenes that we're not aware of that potentially could be put together with what AOL's got and potentially what Verizon has with the network. And then maybe that bloatware that they dump on all their phones will actually start to get good, and then they'll have something that's unique to them, you know?
You just described the script for Battlestar Galactica. You know, it's like a ragtag group of ships join forces to fight off the evil Cylon.
All right.
I don't know. You know, Flickr, I'm wondering about Flickr. That's the big thing. I mean, I haven't used Yahoo in forever since I was there, I think, which is like, you know, double digit years ago. But I still have my Flickr account. I very rarely even upload to my Flickr account for some reason. I don't know. It's kind of like I don't know. It's kind of like the Google Plus of the photo world. Ouch. You know, it's like yeah. it was awesome then, and it was great, and you know everybody was on it, and then you know it was the end of the night at the club, and the lights came on, and you know,
that chick's a dude. You got to take her home. Like, you gotta show her a good time.
She's got a mustache. Oh, no.
Right, right. I think what you brought up is the fact that, like, for anyone who's just a normal person, you date them by if they still have a Yahoo email account, right?
Yeah. Then AOL, like, too.
Right, AOL. AOL, right. Mm-hmm. Then you go, dang. I think with photographers, what's funny is when I tell people I've known someone for a long time online,
yeah,
I go,
you date yourself.
We've been friends since Flickr. And then we were friends on MySpace, and now we're friends on Facebook, and then we finally met, you know, 8 years later.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's...
It's like rings on a tree. Rings on a tree. Yeah, and now you're dating yourself if you even mention email. You know, like, oh, you have an email address? You don't just snap me or you know, just message me? What's this email crap? That's what my dad uses.
Right. You're like, you don't use DMs? I'm like, what?
Exactly. No. Hey, what's going on with that guy?
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's when you instantly date yourself when you're trying to, like, schmooze the opposite sex when you ask for an email address.
Mm-hmm.
Or a phone number, God forbid.
Right.
Don't do the phone number. I don't know, man. But with this acquisition, I mean, even when Verizon purchased AOL, they got AOL's portfolio of properties, which include, you know, companies like TechCrunch, etc. Right? I mean, there's a list of properties that you wouldn't believe that AOL owned. There's also a list of domain names that AOL owned. Because remember, AOL, when they were on top of their game, they were doing the gobbling, right? Because they gobbled up Prodigy, they gobbled up CompuServe, they were Pac-Maning everything. So now Verizon gets all those major brands that were amazing back in the day for pennies, which is kind of crazy. I don't know.
Yeah. No, it is. It brings up, like we said, with the followers thing, it brings up that whole depth versus width conversation. You know, it's like, are you going to sit there and say, all these companies that you got for pennies on a dollar, are they worth the $1 billion, you know, price tag? And no one will know. Yeah. You know what I mean? People could argue that, yes, you're getting it at a much reduced rate than you would have 5-6 years ago, but still a lot of money. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And if it's just like monopoly and you say you own more properties around the table, so it's by default, you should make more money off of them, you'd hope. You know?
So let me read this last, and this story, by the way, came to us from TechCrunch, and TechCrunch, which is an AOL Verizon company now in the Yahoo family. So it says, this is the last paragraph in this, and we'll link over to this in the notes, but it says, Yahoo will be integrated with AOL and Verizon. Executive VP and President of the Product Innovation and New Business Organization, Marnie Walden, is going to lead the process. AOL CEO Tim Armstrong, who, you know, took some heat, a lot of heat last year for certain comments. But AOL CEO Tim Armstrong also mentions Marissa Meyer in his memo. He says, for me personally, I'm planning to stay. I love Yahoo and I believe in all of you. This is Marissa Meyer saying. She said she loves Yahoo. She believes in all of you. This is a memo that she wrote. It's important for me to see Yahoo into its next chapter. This was an internal memo. This transaction is expected to close in Q1 of next year of 2017. So I'm curious as to what this next chapter means, because when Verizon purchased AOL, was there a new chapter? Did we see anything change? I mean, it was like, you know, it was a tree falling in the forest, right? Did anyone, and no one was around to hear it. So I was like, oh yeah, that's interesting. Okay, so back to this other stuff, drones and, you know, all this other crazy innovation that's happening, Snapchat and all these other cool things that are happening, and these big acquisitions of these kind of tarnished, you know, old school brands happens in the background. I'm hoping that, you know, maybe they're building, maybe like, I don't know, Verizon's building some kind of digital Voltron over there, you know? You're going to come out, and it's just going to be like this massive thing that we didn't see coming. I don't know. Julio, is that possible? Are we going to see Voltron?
I think it'll be more like a digital Kuatu than a digital Voltron. It'll just be like the elephant man. It'll be like, I am not an animal. And people will be like, no, dude, you're totally an animal.
No, yeah. Really, you're an animal.
I mean, because look at, like, at Flickr was rebranded or in, you know, reformed online. Then they gave you like unlimited space, and people are like, well, I don't want unlimited space on Flickr. So then they change that, and they're like, we're gonna redo our mobile app so it looks like Instagram, and people like still don't give a shit. You know, I think that it once it's out of the mind of the consumer, you know, I don't know. Like I could see if I can't see into what Verizon's got planned, but if it were me, based on just public knowledge, I think I would maybe even take the names of the brands and just totally like maybe even reformulate them. So it's Flickr's not even Flickr. We're going to call it something else and mm-hmm. launch fresh, mm-hmm. right. you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I agree. Yeah. Cause there's a lot of brand equity in those brands, AOL and Yahoo, but then there's a lot of negative brand equity as well, which I think, you know, is like matter and antimatter. They cancel each other out. So it's like, you know, do you want to fight rage against the machine and use the positive equity in the brand and kind of build up from there and kind of push away the negative, or like you said, Jay, just, you know, start fresh, stand on the shoulders of little people. go for it. I don't know. So with that said, what does this mean? It would, clearly Verizon has a Pac-Man acquisition strategy, right? So what looking at what they've done and kind of plotting the trend line, who's next on that list? I mean, you know, who what's another like bargain basement, relatively speaking, brand that they could go after? Are there any left right now that would make sense for them to grab?
Well, who's going to go after them? Maybe they're setting themselves up to be gobbled up.
Mm.
That's a good point. Yeah.
That's true. Well, hey, I heard speculation that if Trump loses the election, he'll start Trump TV. And then maybe he would buy Verizon.
Nice.
I don't know, man. I have to think about this, because there's got to be another company that they would snap up next, or another couple of companies. Or like, yeah, maybe you're right. They'd get snapped up by a NBC Universal or
GE, you know, or something.
Or GE or even Google, just, you know. Just why not? They have pocket change laying in the couch. They could probably buy them, you know? Or if I doubt if Apple would do it, you know? It doesn't seem to be. And seems like too much of a mess for Apple to even consider at this point.
Apple's got to fix their email app in iTunes right now, and they're struggling with that, so...
Yeah, seriously. Yeah. I gave up on the email app a while ago. I just, if, for some reason... You know why I gave up on Apple's email app? I loved it. I wanted it to be integrated. But I search my mail a lot, and every time I tried to search for something in that app, it couldn't find it, or it would just hang, or something, you know. Whereas in Gmail, I can just go in there and say, you know, I'm looking for messages from : Jose Rosado, everything from Jose right there, from Julio, or sent to Julio, I get everything. Yeah, and I need that. I mean, we work on the internet. I need that. I can't be waiting for something. You know, and dealing with the overhead of a full app. You know, I'm like, if I can do it in my browser and it's fast and it just works, you know, it's just path of least resistance for me.
just works with, like, oh, wait, Apple? No.
Right. It's supposed to work. I mean, that's what you think, right? I don't understand. It doesn't seem like there's like a million really cool apps out there, email apps that work correctly. Why can't the most profitable tech company on earth build something as fundamental as an awesome email app? I don't. It's like, or an awesome music app. Like,
I think it's a unicorn, man. Between that and calendars, every time you get a good calendar service, it gets acquired and then killed. Yeah. Same thing with, you know, the mail, the desktop mail clients. You know, like, it sucks. Like, I still use Sparrow. It's been unsupported for like 4 years.
Yeah. And yeah, I was just getting, you know, into Sunrise. I was like, oh, Sunrise is awesome. And it integrates with Trello and, you know, all this other stuff. I was like, perfect. And then, boom. Hey, by the way, we got acquired by Microsoft and we're shutting it down as we integrate into Exchange.
I'm yeah. Like, and that's like, great. That's happening like in 4 days. I have to figure out how I'm supposed to transfer everything. I forgot. Like, it sucks.
And like, how do you build a business or even something that's, you know, sustainable on this rickety, it's like building on lava or something. You know, like every time, like between WordPress updating every 5 minutes and breaking stuff and apps coming and going and you know, security breaches with emails getting leaked out. You know, it's like, how do you build in this environment? It's like, you're like trying to build a house in a storm with a gag on or blinders on or something.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, like you said, what the whole Verizon deal is going to look like in next year. Because mm-hmm. if you think about it, AOL went through it, right? In the 90s, they were heavy hitters, and everything they spun off had buy AOL. And then in the 2000s, when they started, you know, sputtering a bit, they kind of spun everything off into their own thing and ditched the AOL tagline so that people didn't even know, like, you know, movie phone was theirs and people forgot, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Yeah. And because they knew they had a negative connotation with their brand. So I think it's the same thing. Like, I think of AOL and Yahoo as the same two companies that were worth a lot back in the day, made a lot of missteps, have some really controversial people at the helm and as CEO. And it just... I don't know if they're going to take that and just think, okay, it's been around for, like you said, almost 20 years for one plus 20 for another. It's like maybe that's fine. Maybe they've been around long enough where it doesn't matter. They still have that kind of household name power.
I don't know. Maybe the other side of it, that's a optimistic thinking around this. Maybe the pessimistic thinking around this is, This is the curtain call, you know. This is what the white light looks like for Yahoo. You know, it's getting purchased and absorbed into an entity like Verizon that they could have purchased a couple, you know, a decade ago.
The white light looks like a big red check mark,
or it's a train.
A couple thoughts. Like, no one ever gets excited about Verizon. I never heard anyone ever be like, I can't wait to go to the Verizon store. You know, like, no one ever gets excited about that or about any of the telecoms.
Yeah.
And big ships move real slow. Yeah. They turn slow. And what'll the next big YouTube or Snapchat will be started by a small team. And that's what the Verizon should be looking for. And Apple should be looking for. Rather, what they're doing is they're like, well, let's maybe gobble up Tidal because it's got Jay-Z, and let's go mm-hmm. gobble up Yahoo because it's got nothing. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right. Wait, like, because it's got a cool campus in Sunnyvale. Yeah, yeah, that's what it's got. It's got a really cool campus. I don't know. Yeah, here's a hypothesis. Maybe the era of the giant megalithic .com is over to be replaced by the smaller companies like the Snapchats and the Tinders and those companies that move their fulcrum is a little bit different. They move mm-hmm. a lot of weight with very little effort, and they go in with a business model. You know, these other companies kind of started. Remember when they were starting these businesses? It was like, okay, how are you going to make money? I don't care. We got lots of users. Who cares? You know. And now it's different. It's like, okay, how are you going to monetize this service? Well, with Tinder, we are going to charge them for this, this, and this, you know. And with Snapchat, you know, I don't know how Snapchat makes money, to be honest with you. But
the brands aspect of it. The brands that are on their channel.
Yeah. Oh, right. Yeah, I never go in that area, but yeah.
Me neither. But yeah, like you said, it's definitely, we're in the era of, like, you know, growth hacking. You know what I mean? Where companies can start on nothing.
And which is amazing. It is amazing.
Yeah,
it is amazing.
Great.
You look at Pokemon Go. Pokemon Go is a phenomenon. Admittedly, I have not played the game yet. I've downloaded it, but I have not played it yet.
You're lying.
I swear, I played it in my living room just after I installed it. I was like, okay, but I don't feel like getting up. I did not feel like getting up to go run around my neighborhood to go find these little digital creatures. I said in a post, I said, I will play Pokemon Go when they do an offshoot that's Walking Dead branded. And I'm all over it. I'm all over it. If I can hunt down zombies or, you know.
Yeah. So when you shoot an actual human being in the face.
Zombies aren't technically human beings, you know. They were. Now they're a nuisance. So you're doing the world a solid by getting rid of them.
Yeah. So there's that.
So. I don't know, but there's that. So that, you know, the whole single app economy, which, you know, I think Apple or Pokemon. Who makes Pokemon? Nintendo, right?
So it's not Nintendo. It's some other company. Yeah, it's another company. Nyan. It's
and the company Nyan. Was owned by Google for a while.
Oh, right. Because they had the virtual reality mm-hmm. game.
It was something like that. Because, and the funny thing is, people who didn't realize it, they were posting articles that Nintendo stock doubled
in the last
couple of weeks. Yeah, because of this. And they go, oh, wait, it's not owned by Nintendo. And they're like, oh.
Wow. Yeah.
Poor Nintendo. Maybe they'll get bought up by Verizon and they can all kind of co-suck together.
Yeah, and then the game will only run on Verizon phones.
There you go. And then Sega can join them and they can all just...
Oh, God. Sega, Intellivision, Commodore 64, all those guys. This is cool stuff. I mean, this is classic Silicon Valley, though. It's always like a shakeup or something interesting happening like this. And you ever
watch the show? Do you ever watch the show Silicon Valley?
I have not watched. I live in Silicon Valley, and I've not watched that show yet on purpose.
You have to watch it. It is so
I'm letting it build up for a rainy week. Build up. Got to have something in the queue to like go
Right. I think you're gonna really appreciate it because, like you said, you're in the know, and I find things humorous, and I know I'm not in the know, so I can only imagine people who watch it are like, oh my God, that character is making fun of this guy. I know that guy. Oh my God, he is that way. You know what I mean? Like, it's pretty tongue in cheek, but hysterical.
All right, let me check it out after I finish with Mr. Robot. We'll see how that goes.
I haven't gotten to that either.
Oh, dude. All right, don't get me started. I'm sorry, listeners.
How do you watch it? Like Amazon? I don't even know where it is now. I can't
Mr.
Remember.
Robot. It's on. God, is it USA? I think it's a USA show, but I watch it on iTunes. I just buy it's two seasons. There's only one season, and as we record this, the third episode of the second season is out. So, one full season and three episodes. So.
Okay, yeah.
And it is,
check it out, but we cut the cord
that
recently.
That show, the last episode that I watched, and TWIP listeners, I know you're going to agree with me if you watch that show. The last season, or episode three of season two, I'm just going to say one word, Adderall. That's all I got to say. And you'll know what I'm talking about. Adderall. That was the most ridiculous scene I've ever seen in my life. So you got to check it out. Maybe I'll make that my pick of the week. I don't know. All right, guys. So, you have it. So we'll put the links to all this stuff in the notes for this acquisition. But once again, Verizon, the telecom giant, has acquired Yahoo, the once dominant internet behemoth, for a paltry $4.83 billion. So check it out. All right, guys, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, could Canon be preparing to release lenses that have digital displays built into them? This episode of TWIP is brought to you by Photomatics. Photomatics Pro is the industry-leading software for HDR photography, offering a wide range of effects from the most natural-looking to highly artistic and surreal, along with the best in alignment of handheld photos, advanced ghost removal, and much more. Are you new to HDR photography? Well, you should check out Photomatics Essentials. It's for those that are new to this technique. It's got a simplified workflow and built-in guidance for bracketing your images, and it still has the strength of Photomatics. And brand new to the Photomatics lineup is Photomatics OneShot. It's an extension for Apple Photos that adds Photomatics magic to single exposures. Download your free trial today. The trial does not expire, and it just adds a Photomatics watermark to the final image. It's perfect for getting your feet wet and trying out the technique everyone has been talking about. HDRsoft.com has video tutorials and other resources to help you get started. Just head over to HDRsoft.com and click on download. That's HDRsoft.com and click on download. Photomatics Pro, it's the easiest way to create stunning HDR photos. All right, guys, we are back. Canon lenses may soon have digital displays. So, reliable sources are reporting that Canon may soon be releasing a new lens that will include a digital display built into the lens. Zeiss was the first company to introduce a digital display into a lens, but is this something that photographers need or want? Julio Shorio, is this a cure in search of a disease, or do you need this in your camera bag?
I don't desire it, so... I can't speak for everybody, but I don't think I would use it. I think I think it could be cool. I mean, if you really need to judge your depth of field and you have a hard time looking through the viewfinder, I think it could be helpful. And for more technical photography, it could be helpful. Perhaps they could program in some sort of cool rack focusing effects for video. I mean, who knows what other technologies would potentially come along with that. But off the bat, man, I'm kind of old school, like depth of field scale.
That's me right there. Know. I see this. You know, I live in the center of technology, so I love innovations in technology. But when I look at this, I think of more crap to fail and more firmware updates. That's what I see. Like, I already have to update the firmware of my lenses to begin with. And now, you know, there's more places for things to crash and bugs to get in there and all this stuff. Jose, what about you, man? You need a display on your lenses?
No, I mean, like I think, like you said, it definitely begs the question of. I remember the last time I was on here, we were talking about Leica's digital camera that came out with no LCD on the back, right? Mm-hmm. And you argued that, or anyone would argue that it was because it was basically the people who love shooting film, but also want the digital medium. That they would find that like appealing, like the crossover, right? Yeah. Right, for $6,000, but or more than that. I can't remember what it was more.
Like,
but
it's like bondage in digital photography. You know, just like to be bound for inexplicable reasons.
Right? Exactly. So for me, like I remember the first time I shot with my A7, my Sony, the digital like viewfinder, it freaked me out. Like I didn't, you know, like I understood it like what it meant. And I had friends who shot video on their DSLR series for a while, and had saw like the, you know, the focus peaking and all that stuff that that Julio mentioned, and saw the benefits. But to me, as a still guy, I looked at it like it just ate batteries, and it was cool. But at the same time, I just kind of was like, you know, it wasn't like anything that I could really have to say I needed.
Yeah. The other thing, and gee, I really want you to chime in on this, because I know you kind of helped introduce me into this whole, you know, next generation mirrorless world. But these kinds of innovations, when we see these kind of things, does this represent the next step, you think, in evolution of lenses? Or is it half of me is like, yeah, okay, yeah, it's right now the lenses are analog, making them digital for, like you said, a graphical representation of depth of field or things like that. Yeah, maybe that's cool. But on the other side, is it the manufacturers, you know, sitting in their conference room saying, man, dude, we got to come up with something. We got to come up with something to put on that spec sheet for the next trade show. What could it be? Johnson, what do you got? LEDs on the lenses. Okay, put that on the whiteboard. Shurio, what do you got? Pokemon in the lenses. I don't know. What do you think, man?
Canon is trying to stay relevant straight up. You know, the thing is, if you have a mirrorless camera, that information that would be on that screen can just as easily be in the EVF, could be on the LCD screen. You would never have to take your eye off of the display, and then you would be able to work faster. I mean, that would be a great feature to have on my Lumix cameras. And I know Sony shooters love to have their depth of field scale on the information display in their EVF. Why not? Why isn't it there? Canon can't do that. They can't do that.
I want the depth of field display in augmented reality inside the scene.
There you go.
Like, I want to see, if I'm taking a picture of Jose, I want to see a scale behind him and in front of him so I know where I can position him within that range graphically.
There you go. And you could do that with a mirrorless camera. You'll never be able to do that with a DSLR. So Canon, I think, just they need to sell more lenses. And once most Canon shooters get their 2.8 zooms, they're kind of set. There's not a whole lot more that they really need. So if they have a refresh, then maybe it'll just kind of help them stay in the minds of users. But the other thing is too, maybe the manufacturing processes for their current lenses are just aging, and if they have to replace those, then it's like, well, why not add a few extra features just to have something else to talk about?
Yeah, or just a combination of all that. I tend to think that it's probably let's figure out how we can monetize our existing user base you know, and the mounts that are already out there and give those guys, you know, hey, you know, these guys have been sitting on the 7200 or 7300 or whatever for far too long. Even though it's good, let's give them something to buy and upgrade to. And, you know, I don't know, Jose, what you think, is that plausible? That it's just, is it innovation for innovation's sake, or is it innovation that is solving a problem? I think is the crux of the question.
I think it's like G mentioned, I think it's like a basically a gamble. It's like, you know, we see the general direction where trends are going, and we're just going to toss this out and see if it works. Now, we could argue that because they've been around for so long and they have such a, you know, a big company, a large following, that in reality they can afford to kind of take some of these gambles and say, hey, this might work, this might not. If it doesn't, okay, we scrap it and we just lost like, you know, a year or two of innovation or R&D, whatever, maybe more, but on this idea. But you mentioned, I mean, this is like a similar problem. Like, I do a lot of writing for Chimera, and the people I interview, it's almost laughable because they have a problem where their product is too good. And there's a lot of photographers who love their softboxes and their lighting modifiers, and they just, you know, Chimera will call them and be like, hey, look, you know, you want to upgrade and get the new one, and here's why. And they're just like, no, mine's 20 years old, still kicking, loving it. Thank you for making such a great product. Mm-hmm. And they're sitting there going like, well, that sucks. We're too good at our jobs, you know? Right. And then you sit there and say, like a lot of people think is, you know, it's almost like that ad age where it's like people talk about, if you make gum last longer, you're going to now suddenly, like, people aren't going to buy more gum. You know,
that's exactly right. It's right. Like cars,
right?
You know? It's,
right.
If we can build a spacecraft, you know, that can go all the way to Jupiter and withstand Jupiter's electromagnetic radiation, orbit it, take photos, and then, you know, crash itself into the planet. But we can't build a car that lasts more than 10 years, right? So, you know, it's built in and planned obsolescence to keep the industry alive.
Exactly.
You know? So, I mean, in some ways, that makes a lot of sense, right? Because on the one hand, yeah, it would be great to have a vehicle that lasts forever. But on the other hand, maybe not so much, because trends change, innovations happen, and, you know, you're going to be stuck with a car that's bulletproof that lasts forever. You're like, man, I should have waited 2 years to get that one.
No, you're right. I mean, you think of the same thing with cars, right? You bring up a good one where maybe just, I don't even know, 10 years ago, you started seeing cars where they would build in the navigations, but it was still like the more higher end cars. And then you see cars now where, like, a, you know, $15,000 Kia has built-in navigation and a backup camera. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly now they're saying by, I don't even know, 2018, 2020, all cars manufacturer are going to have a backup camera standard. So it's like, that's not, you know, it went from a luxury thing to a luxury add-on to a standard. So maybe they're hoping or they're thinking this is the bet. You know, everyone's going towards mirrorless and going towards, you know, all electronic things. Maybe we should kind of try it, you know, and I don't know, because it's the same thing. Like, I have a bunch of Nikon gear. I don't feel like I need anything anymore, you know, and they make this add-on, and who knows, maybe I'll get something new for my D4, but maybe I won't, you know, at the same time.
Well, they say, so the displays on these lenses, they show focus distance and depth of field information. I don't know what that means, but probably just a numerical scale, I'm guessing. And they're backlit, meaning photographers can work with them in darkness without lighting. So I'd want that other stuff. The lighting, that sounds kind of cool. That's what Sigma did. Was it? What, not Sigma. I'm sorry. Ricoh did that with their DSLR. They made this radical step of, instead of, well, in addition to like making a bunch of other changes to the camera, the dials and all that stuff on the back of the camera are backlit illuminated. So at night or in darkness, they light up a little bit. So, hey, you can find them without like trying to find a light source to look at this camera that is designed to capture light, you know?
So
that makes a lot of sense to do that. I don't know if I care that much about like how often, like both of you guys, how often when you're out in the field shooting, do you feel like, okay, I need precise depth of field information or else I can't get this shot? Or, you know, or is this, like I said, is this a cure in search of a disease? Have you ever, Jose, have you ever been in that situation where you're like, okay, I need to know my exact depth of field ratio or the numbers, you know, in order to do the right, get the right shot for this particular scene?
I think it comes down to, you know, who's your target market, right? I mean, because mm-hmm. you could sit there and argue that any professional who has worked their salt, who knows how to do that in camera or knows their settings or knows their stuff, would not really struggle with that. But then, like, we also have the flip side of that coin, and we sit there and say, well, even when you're at the professional level, you're expected to get higher and higher keeper rates, right? You're expected to get the shot every time without fail. So if you have something to add to that, you know, that'll help. And think of like sniper rifles, right? I mean, snipers yeah. know how to do that stuff in their head, but then they make scopes that are pretty much just like autopilot for a bullet, you know?
Right.
And right. it's, you know, it's kind of, I don't know, because I can sit there and say, well, if I know how to do it, why would I care? But again, like you mentioned, it's something that if it's a benefit, it's a benefit. Like, I know how to back up in my car, but I love having a backup camera the last
That's
few
true.
Years. You know what
That's
I mean?
True.
So I personally, maybe because I haven't gone in the field and used it, I don't really see a benefit to it right now. But I mean, like you said, maybe through using it, you might see, okay, I could see how this would work. I could see how it would help me out without really needing even to guess. But then we get into that gray area with that slippery slope where you sit there and say, my girlfriend, we had the bike rack on the car for a family vacation this summer, and she went to go back up and couldn't see with her backup camera and freaked out. And she's like, what do I do? And I go, what you did for the previous 28 years of your
wow.
life? Like, did you
wow.
forget? You know, but it's so quickly how we
see
can
see that
kinda
reflective surface up there, right. you know?
Right? Or you sit there and say, like, with cell phones, I don't remember anyone's number anymore. If my
yeah,
cell phone
no,
dies,
true.
I'm kind of screwed,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
So,
well, and there's no way I can remember everybody's number. I don't know. Gee, what about you? I mean, is this feature the equivalent of the backup camera that Jose has on his minivan?
Well, I don't know if it's even that useful. You know, the thing is, if you're focused on your vision, then you're going out and you're creating what you love and what you're passionate about, and then the technique feeds into that. And the craft mm-hmm. feeds into that, and then the technology feeds into all of that. So if you're, you know, like I'm a portrait photographer, I grew up with Hasselblad, and I grew up, then I got into 35 millimeter later on, and I knew mm-hmm. what f-stops and what focal lengths I needed. I didn't have to be like, well, let me check everything every damn time, because I was mm-hmm. shooting enough where I just had it in my head. And then when I switched to Micro Four Thirds, it took me about 6 months to kind of adjust to the different f-stops equivalents, and I'm good to go. So I don't necessarily need all that information, because I'm practicing my craft, and I'm putting time and effort into that, so that stuff is, you know, I mean, so if you have depth of field, say we do get depth of field on your LED screen, and it's all floating in front of you, and then you have f-stop and aperture and a live histogram and audio meters, and I mean, when are you going to be able to stop and see the image?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's true. You're going to miss it. You're going to miss it.
And then
it.
It's like, it's too much. And then what happens is all of this technology starts to become a barrier, and you may end up becoming more of a technically proficient photographer because you're following these guides set up on the camera, but you may end up becoming less of a creative photographer. And quite frankly, if you're going to be successful as a professional photographer today, you got to put more of the focus into the vision and the creativity than you do in the technique, because anybody can learn to light right and all. Anybody can learn to do that, you know. But like when I'm on a shoot, I hire technicians. I am hired for my vision, and it's a big difference. It's a big difference in pay scale. It's a big difference in the kind of work you do. And I think that having, I don't know, I'm not really feeling the screens on the lens. I just don't need
well,
it.
Well, I knew. I'm glad Bruce put this story in here, because I knew you were gonna. I knew you were gonna say that, because you're railing against more. The more is more kind of thinking. You and David Duchemin, you know, it's like, you know, less is more. Do more with what you have, but don't forsake the gear. Just don't be Batman and have every available device, you know, so that you can fight whatever criminal comes at you, right? So I don't know. I don't know. Jury's out. We'll see it. I don't want to completely dismiss it, but I don't see me ever needing, unless it came on the lens that I was buying. I don't think I would buy a lens to get this particular feature, but if it was on a particular focal length lens that I was going to buy anyway, I wouldn't kick it out of bed. You know, I'm like, okay, you know, I'll get it.
I wonder when the rental houses are going to pick them up and figure maybe that could be fun just to try it out. But then again, like anything like that, you can't just try it once. You have to try it for like a few months to get used to it and really kind of see the benefits. But
I was going to ask you guys, Jose, have you ever shot film? You shot film before, right?
Me? No, not in my career.
So, Julio, I know you've shot film. So
plenty.
On the old DSLRs that like my old Nikon, for example, like the old F4s and the F3s and the F2s and the FM2s, they had this button on there, the depth of field preview button. You remember that button? That when I first started learning photography, I was like, oh, you know, you go through your camera and like, what does this button do? What is this button? You know, and I found that button. And all, you know, what it does is it stops down the aperture, but it doesn't give you an accurate depth of field preview.
Never did it on digital cameras either.
Yeah, it dims the image. All it did was dim the image, and I'm like, what is this? Clearly, I don't know how to use this camera because I know it says depth of field preview, but it's not. I don't see a preview. I just see a darker image. Have you ever used that particular function on any of your cameras?
I lived by it because I mean, with the right light and the right shot, you could really see your depth of field.
Really?
You really could. You know, it does make it darker. Well, it does make it darker because it's letting in less light, but what you can't be focused on the darkness, you got to focus on the sharpness. So when I would focus on someone's eyes, say with a 50 millimeter, which is one of the lenses I like to shoot portraits with often, you know, then you stop down to 5.6, you know, before you stop down, the lens is opened up to f1.4, mm-hmm. And nothing's really too sharp. As soon as you stop it down, things do get darker, but you have to look through that, and then you sometimes hold it down a little longer and let your eyes adjust if you have to, but then see, okay, from the eyes to the ears is in focus or to the tip of the nose, and then you could actually, while you're holding that down, then I would actually tweak my focus a little more so I can get the ideal depth of field for that portrait and then shoot.
Yeah, see, I feel like you know, there was a feature that I could have been using all these years and just didn't understand how to use it. I should have asked you back then.
The problem, though, is with the depth of field scale on modern lenses that are focused by wire, there's a lot of slop in the focus by wire.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, it's a lot, because it's not, I mean, the mechanics is the mechanics. It's gears. Mm-hmm. So as long as it's manufactured well, you know the distance that you're focused on is correct and the depth of field scale is correct. But when I first started, say like with Micro Four Thirds, one of my favorite lenses was the Olympus 12-2.0. Mm-hmm. But the depth of field scale is off by like 5 feet. I mean, it's like 5 feet. I'm just like, okay. And you never
Do you test that? How do you?
Well, it had a depth of field scale and you put markers out 5, 10 feet, 15 feet or whatever. You know, and you just measure from the sensor plane to that distance is 5 feet. Set the lens to 5 feet. Is it sharp? No. Okay. Well, depth of field scale is off. Is it really, really off? On some apertures, it was, and some apertures, it wasn't. It's just because it's a focus by wire lens, and so it's never really accurate. See, if there was, and the Canons are focused by wire, so I mean, maybe there it could be useful for those lenses because they're focused by wire, and the Nikons, you know, any of the lenses that are focused by wire, any new lens in the last like 10 years is focused by wire. Yeah. So I think maybe the screen could be helpful if it's accurate and if it adjusts, but
yeah, if they make the lenses smarter, which they can. Because they're software driven, right?
Yeah. But I got two words for you though. Back focus. Canon's notorious for back focus.
Yeah. So, and describe back focus. That's when you think you're focused on your subject and you're actually focused. Like, I think I'm focused on your nose and I'm focused on a chair behind.
Yeah, it's just because of the sun. So with film, the plane was always moving, and the way light hit the film plane, the lens could be a little slightly off. It was a little, for whatever reason, I don't know technically, but it was easier for the lenses to get accurate focus on a particular distance from the film plane to the subject. Digital, I believe it has something to do with the sensor having each pixel inside of a well, and then the lens has to be focused directly into the well. And I think that you have to have much more accurate lenses.
You're very smart, Julia. Like, what the hell, man? Mind sufficiently blown. You just obsoleted my entire lens inventory here. Thank you. I appreciate that. Cool. All right, guys, let's move on to this next story. Look at that. We're almost out of time again. You see how quickly TWIP goes? So story number three, we'll touch on this really quickly. So this is from Refinery29. So a recent interview with an anonymous retoucher who spent most of her career retouching for famous brands, including Victoria's Secret, reveals her techniques and shares some insights into what goes into retouching for many of the world's biggest brands. So this story, I mean, it's interesting just to get kind of her take on that the insider look at that world. But one of these, what did she say in here? I'm reading through the article. It says, I'm paraphrasing, but she says, actually, here it is. She wants us to understand how unreal the bodies we see are from head to toe, literally. At the same time, she wants us to understand our own role in propagating these images. As a society, she says, we're the ones who choose this. So, Jose Rosado, we've talked about this on TWIP. We haven't talked about it like in recent memory, but we used to talk about this whole idea of the negatives around retouching people to an unrealistic and unattainable body image. And she's basically going through and revealing how they do it and pulling the covers off of that. How do you feel about that? How do you feel about retouching to make the image, though unrealistic, more, you know, quote unquote, aesthetically pleasing versus leaning more on the side of reality?
I mean, obviously, I dealt with that a lot in my own work over the years, you know, because I used to see a lot of like fashion editorial stuff, but I was the same way. I mean, I looked at it like in the beginning, even the girls who were paying me and it wasn't agency work or any agency models at the time, you know, that was the one thing I kind of realized was, you know, it's on both sides of the fence. It's like as a person, you're paying me, and if I retouch the photos and you knowingly know you look different than you normally look, you might get offended or you might all of a sudden have a, you know, body image problem, that sort of thing. And then on the other flip side of it, when you're a working model and you are signed by an agency, you also run that risk of when you show up, you know, yes, you have digitals and Polaroids and that kind of stuff, but you show up and all of a sudden you don't look like your images, then you're in trouble too. Mm-hmm.
Catfish.
You know what I mean? So I think one time I did something to an image and it, you know, and that was just to play around with it, just to see if I could do it in terms of my retouching work. And then not too long after that, the girl got a nose job. So, I mean, I guess I kind of felt like, not like it was entirely my fault, but, yeah. You know, it makes you think, you know what I mean? Makes you think.
I don't know. I think I understand this, and I applaud this person for revealing this. Everything's always a double-edged sword, because on the one hand, and I think it goes back to journalistic or the when you present an image as real versus when you present an image as unreal or as art, you know, or an artist's interpretation or depiction of a person or a scene or whatever. If it's clear that this is art, I think all rules go out the window. You can do whatever you want. You can give three eyeballs, four legs, whatever, you know, because it's art. It's your interpretation. But if you're much like photojournalism, if you're putting this in a magazine where people that are reading the magazine are going to see that and assume that that's real, especially young girls, not to say young girls are, you know, 100% naive, but young people that are looking at that and see, hey, that's the idealistic body image that I want to fashion myself after, and I'm too fat because I don't look like that, then now you're doing damage to someone's psyche and all that. Oh, that's just what I think. Julio, what about you? What do you think?
Well, I think this year really revealed some truths about at least Americans with the political climate that we have, and it has shown us to...
You mean that we have no sense? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. And putting it mildly, that we may, like they say, there's a sucker born every minute. Yeah. they're,
I would argue the world has no sense. I mean, you know,
in general.
Yeah, the EU and British. Yeah, it's the world has gone insane. Yeah,
I think that, you know, articles like this come up every once in a while. If people are surprised that things are being reached, these women are being retouched, if they're surprised that they don't really look like that in real life, you know, they probably have worse shit going on than that in their lives.
Are you trying to say those are the people that believe that video games are real and they go out and shoot people based on the game?
If there was a place where women like this looked in like a country, we'd all have known about it by now. We'd all known about it. We'd be taking vacations there.
Dude, you know, I think that country is called Brazil.
Maybe, you know, I mean, dude, maybe Canon can invent a beer goggle lens. No matter who you point it at, to look badass. Right. You know, you the go. Beer goggle lens by Canon.
Yeah.
Here you go.
You know?
Yeah.
And the beer goggle lens light. You know, I mean, of course they're going to be retouched. Of course. Yeah. Of course. Yeah. No one's going to be like, hey, you know, because like a lot of young college girls like to buy those clothes or the bras and panties. And it's like, okay, great. Let's get all these freshmen in and put on their freshman 20 and get them in a catalog.
Yeah.
You ain't going to sell bra and panties like that, you know.
I remember, a couple of years ago, I interviewed Arnie Freytag. He's an American photographer. Does glamour. He works for Playboy. In fact, I interviewed him on the set of a Playboy shoot a couple of years ago, and he was saying, if I recall correctly, he was telling me that he did not, or I don't know, it was kind of weird. He was saying that none of the images that he shot that appeared in Playboy were retouched. So, you know, and then, you know, you look at those images and you're like, okay, either this woman was kept in a box and fed through a hole her entire life, or some Photoshop was you know involved in the making of this image, and I don't, you know, in a magazine like Playboy, who cares, you know? So, even now they don't have any nudes in Playboy, right?
So did away with them,
they did away with that. In an image like that, in a magazine, there's no expectation of reality. I don't think, you know, you don't look at Playboy like you're looking at, you know, I don't know, so, like. Nat Geo, the Wall Street Journal or something. You're not like, you know, it's like, okay, this is real. You know, you're like, okay, I want to see people looking, you know, unrealistically great. Why not? That's why I paid for this magazine. So, I don't know. So, G, you never retouch anybody then, right? Is that what you're saying?
No, I mean, when it will help the image overall for commercial work, totally. I'm not a fan of overly retouched images. I felt that kind of peaked out in 2007. You know, that was like a byproduct of an overinflated artificial economy. Was an over retouched artificial looking images. And I think now, just with the trend of like, hey, we have a 36 megapixel full frame sensor. It's clean at ISO 56,000. I'm gonna put in Lightroom and add gray into it, and add a filter on it, and make it look bad. You know, it's like we're in a different world now. So I think that it could be. I think it would be a smart move to stop retouching. And I know a lot of smaller catalogs do very minimal retouch and a pimple.
That's
here,
where I would go. Know. I wouldn't say you need to stop retouching. I think you don't need to retouch like to that nth degree. I think retouching for me is like, it should be like plastic surgery. If someone can tell that you had work done, you failed, right?
So, right.
You know, the retoucher should look realistic. They should leave some flaws. It shouldn't look unrealistically perfect. All humans are flawed, most of us, right?
Right.
To some degree. So, you know, that should be reflective in the final image. If you make it too perfect, then it's, you know, your brain is going to say, hey, that's not real.
Right.
I don't know. All right, guys, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to answer a question from one of our listeners. I'd like to formally invite you to check out the brand new TWIP School. You've learned so much from the amazing TWIP hosts and guests over the years. Now, within the TWIP School, you can continue that learning and dive deeper on a variety of photographic and business topics. There are already several great courses to choose from in the school, and we will be adding new courses often. Right now, you can learn about fashion photography from Lucas Passmore, Final Cut Pro 10 for photographers, and time-lapse with Lee Herbert, marketing for photographers with Zach Prez, and even time travel for photographers with yours truly. truly. And to kick things off, you can check out the school today with a course that we've made available for free for a limited time only. And that's 5 Habits of Highly Effective Photographers. It's an inspirational course designed to help you get more done and stay focused. So head over to the brand new TWIP school now at school.thisweekinphoto.com. That's school.thisweekinphoto.com. All right, guys, for the second or this last segment on the show, we periodically answer questions and respond to feedback that has come in from the TWIP Army. This week, we have a question from Lisa Cozini. Did I pronounce that right? Cozini or Cozin? She says, I have a question about using the interval timer option on the Fuji X-T1. I've become somewhat obsessed lately with taking pictures of lightning. Awesome. I set the focus and exposure depending on the time of day, then set the interval timer to take a picture every second. I use a 16 gigabyte memory card, and I go until it's full. When I need to switch out the card, I notice it is hot to the touch, and at times the camera body is a bit warm. Am I damaging my camera shooting in this manner? Now, I know none of you guys shoot Fuji, right? Mm-hmm. Jose, you don't shoot Fuji, right? Yeah, and neither do I. So this is a general question about using the interferometer on a camera. If the camera / card, etc., get warm after a period of time, is that normal? Jose, what do you think? Is that normal? Should she be concerned?
I mean, it depends on, again, like if you think about it, it's like you have think about what you make a camera go through. It's almost like I know someone would have to try and do like the live view, and they would mm-hmm. and they would wonder why. You know, there's a delay when they then go to take a photo. And it's like, well, when you think of what live view is doing, you're basically asking the camera to work twice as hard instead of just using, you know, the viewfinder. And, you know, there's going to be a delay, right? So, and then if you take that same logic and say, well, if you do something like she is to take all these photos, you know, you're asking the camera to work pretty hard. And you know, it is going to get to a point where it might get a little warm. And then you wonder, hey, then it comes down to like people make fun of NASCAR a lot, right? And mm-hmm. I like watching it, but the funny thing to me is the engineering aspect of it. Because in a lot of other racing, you have cars that do more than just make left turns, right? So they brake, right. And the engine RPMs go up and down. But in NASCAR, you have literally a motor at near red line for 3 hours straight. So it's like, And if they don't blow, that to me is like a modern marvel, you know, of engineering.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like that sense where that I think it is too normal to a degree, but how much can you do it and how long until it does break? I don't know. I mean, I've never been the one to do like, you know, 20-minute exposures while, you know, camping in the woods. So I couldn't really be a great person to answer that. But I think it's, you know, it's one of those things where I wouldn't worry too much. I mean, it's kind of standard from what you're doing to your camera, but at the mm-hmm. same time,
yeah, the camera's designed to do that, right? It's built into the camera. I don't know. Gee, you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, totally. I think it's a good question that Lisa asked. I mean, heat is the number one thing that keeps most cameras from doing things like shooting 4K video. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a big, I mean, heat is the enemy. It's the reason why computers are underclocked or the fans turn on or computers will throttle down when they get hot, because the electronics can only operate for so long at extended temperatures. Now, I don't think that the camera is being damaged. Potentially, though, depending on the brand and quality of the memory card could be damaged because it's just going to overheat. Typically, if a camera overheats, it's just going to shut down until it could operate at a normal working temperature. It's unlikely the card would be damaged, but I don't know what brand that she's using. You know, the better memory card you have, you're going to be able to utilize the full speed of the data bus in the Fuji camera, whatever camera you're using, and that'll help keep things cool. What you will see, Lisa, is if you're shooting with your camera and it's continuing to get warm, is you may see, depending on the camera model, more pronounced noise in your images. Okay, and that's normal, but if anything, you'll see more noise in your image. I don't think mm-hmm. you're going to damage your camera.
Yeah. Well, she's not doing long exposure. She's doing She says, I set the focus.
She's
and
doing
exposure
intervalometers, right?
Yeah, one picture every second. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's making the camera work harder. It's going to get hotter. It could potentially introduce noise. I don't think it'll damage it. I mean, if you look at like the new Fuji X-T2, does 4K video, but the time is limited depending on whether or not you have the grip on there. And I think they're doing that to cycle the heat from one battery to the next.
Oh,
you know, and that's the reason why like a camera like the Lumix GH4 is bigger than other Micro Four Thirds cameras, or the GX8 is bigger than other Micro Four Thirds cameras, is because they run hotter.
Yeah, so that extra body is acting as a heat sink so that it can keep going.
Exactly, and I think that's why most Sony cameras that can shoot 4K internally don't shoot 4K for very long internally, because the bodies are so small that they hold on to a lot of heat.
Yeah, heat. That's the main issue in a lot of things, right? So heat dissipation and longevity, even cars, everything. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, you have to figure out a way to get rid of that heat, or else you fail with these mechanical, because a camera is a mechanical device, electronics and mechanics, which don't necessarily play well together. And then you introduce heat in there and it could get chaotic. Especially when you try to do something as precision as capture the precise amount of light to image something on a sensor. So, perfect. Great answer, G. Perfect. Both of you guys. All right, Twib listeners, if you have a question you want us to answer, just click on the Contact Us link at the top of the page and select Twib, which is the main show, to submit your question. And if you have a question for any of our other shows or hosts, you can ask them a question as well by just selecting their show, typing your question, and hitting submit, and they will get it. Actually, when you submit a question to one of the hosts, including me, it actually pops up on the iPhone right then. So
wow,
it's not like it goes into an inbox. Yeah, we've got it all wired up through Trello and Slack and everything. So, you know, we're on it. We're a news organization, man. Come on. All right, guys, let's move on to our Picks of the Week segment. Remember, you guys can pick anything to recommend to the Twip Army as long as it is somehow related to photography, even tangentially related to photography. Julio Shorey, I'm going to let you go first. What is your Pick of the Week?
My Pick of the Week is the Tenba DNA 13 bag. I actually got it right here, and
oh, look at that!
It is a beauty,
that is pretty.
And it is. It not only does it look good, but it is super functional. I have an Everyday Messenger Peak Design, which is also a nice bag. But I mean, I can work so much faster. Yeah, there you go. I mean, the Tenba bag.
Let's see that, Jose. Let me see it.
This one's a throwback.
Yeah.
Essentially,
the Tenba DNA series replaced the Messenger series that we just saw there, but it's such a fast bag to shoot out of, and it is so comfortable to use. And then if I just want to use it as an everyday messenger, I could pull the entire insert out, and I still got, you know, and I could still hold a 13-inch laptop, or what I use mine for is my iPad Pro. I mean, I can't say enough good things about it. It's a wonderful bag.
And you like this bag better than the Everyday Messenger?
It's more functional.
Or do they do different things?
No, it's more. I like my Everyday Messenger because I think that I don't understand it enough. I think I like it for some things, but for ours, like, okay, so I did an assignment in Chicago some months ago with the Everyday Messenger, and I really struggled to pull the camera out of the top zipper, like the top access.
Yeah.
And I'm shooting Micro Four Thirds cameras. These are not big cameras. But right, I can hold so much more gear in my DNA 13, and I could access it faster in the DNA 13 than I can in Everyday Messenger. And it's a smaller bag. You know, it's just a really, really well thought out bag. I mean, I guess...
Can you get a computer in there, like a 13-inch?
Yeah, MacBook, you can put a 13-inch laptop. I use mine for my MacBook or my my iPad Pro, my 13-inch iPad Pro. I mean, it's probably. I haven't enjoyed a shoulder bag this much before. It's super comfortable.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And what do these cost? Let's see. What's the price point? Where is it? Let's see. Oh, $159.
Yeah.
So $160. Not bad. Oh, and colors too. Look at that. Yeah.
But I don't know if I can.
I would go with the gray.
I can get it to work on camera, but the way these little buckles attach is with magnets. So once it's on, it's on. If you want to take it off, you just move it to the side. But the Velcro, if you pull down on the Velcro and then up, It's super silent. I'll try to get it to work in this weird angle. But so it probably sounds louder, but if I pull up on it, do you hear the difference?
Yeah.
So that's
yeah.
that's the normal Velcro, and this is more of the there you go.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So which is amazing for Velcro. I'm like, oh my God. So you don't, you know, I mean, other camera, other bag companies have added like little dummy Velcro straps to put over them, and you don't have to do that with this. So it was less fussing with the bag and more working with it. So I'll put like, I did an assignment in Arizona in February, and I brought a four SSD RAID. I brought a 2GH4s, iPad Pro, a whole bunch of stuff.
Wow. I'm looking at this. Yeah, and that insert comes right out of there, too, huh?
Yeah, just like the old, well, like my old Tembo, same thing. You can pull that out and use. And I used to use it. Very cool. I used to use it as a laptop bag back in the day.
I love where camera bags are going these days, man. It's like finally we're getting cool camera bags. You know, LowPro's making cool bags as well. I remember I was shooting LowPro bags or using LowPro bags back in my days in the military. I think I got my first LowPro bag. It was one of those big. You remember those big giant bags that you could get like your entire car into it, and yeah, I had two DSLRs in it, multiple flashes, all kinds of lenses, film, all this stuff, and yeah, this was way back in the day, and I think I probably still have that bag. It just, you know, they just go forever. They get dirty, but you know, at least they go forever. Cool, man. G, that was a perfect pick of the week. Thank you. All right, Jose Rosado, man, what is your pick of the week?
So my pick of the week is actually something that so recently on the show, we did an episode on the importance of backing up your work. So we had Jeremy Cowart come back on. And
I've heard of him.
And we ended up approaching GTEC because it was just to me, it made sense because I've used their drives my whole career. And I love their products, and we talked when we were at WPPI this year and kind of pitched them the idea, and we finally made it happen. And I think that for me, especially now traveling with the show and that sort of thing, it was the EV ATCs, like the all-terrain cases, if you've seen those, that really kind of got me interested, because I sat there and I thought of all the things, like I have older GTEC drives that came with like a leather case, and while it was very fashionable, not very practical, because I would still get, you know, nervous about dumping this in a bag with tons of other you know, gear. And especially now where I'm not traveling in with my photography gear. Now I'm traveling with a bunch of just radio podcasting equipment. So it's just like I'm dumping all this stuff in a Chrome messenger bag, and it's not compartmentalized or, you know, padded or anything like that, because I literally can put, and I'll show you, everything I need for a multiple person recording fits in a bag like this. And it's just a normal messenger size bag. And I'm talking for, I can record with six people just with all the stuff I fit in there. And I started getting nervous. So I started putting my hard drive in there in leather case wrapped in a t-shirt. And I felt like I was back where I was when I was starting out in photography. I didn't have all the nice, you know, bags and Kate Pelican cases and stuff. So, I started looking at these drives, and they really kind of stood out to me as a great kind of, thing to have that you can do. I can just toss that in my bag and not even care, you know.
Now are you using it for backup, or can you edit video off of it? Is it fast enough for
that? They do have a solid state version, and then they have a Thunderbolt version, and I think the transfer rates on the solid state's up there. I think it's like either 300 or almost 500 megabytes per second, whereas I know the regular Thunderbolt one is like 136 kind of transfer rate.
136, yeah. I'm looking at it, yeah. Yeah, capacity 1 terabyte. You can get it in one of two interfaces, a Thunderbolt case or a USB 3.0. Drive speed 7200 RPM, which is, you know, obviously not solid state, but that non-solid state spinning platter gives you 136 megabytes per second. And I, where is, let's see if we can, I can't see the the SSD one. That seems like that would be the one I would go for, that SSD.
Yeah.
If I could.
I think that one, for the same size, I think that one jumps up from 229 to like almost 500.
Oh, you could get a G, you can get a G-Rack 12, up to 2000 megabytes per second at 7200 RPM. 120 terabytes for how much, Jose?
Exactly.
$33,000. Am I reading that right?
Yeah.
I don't see. Yeah. That. There's a lot of numbers in there. No, that's cool, man. So, but the, yeah, the one we're talking about is the G-Tech one.
Okay, yeah.
Is...
So if you look up, it has a solid state there. So those little black drives actually go in that case. So you could.
Oh, okay.
Right,
these guys.
So you
okay.
can get just the case. And then just, you know, swap out the drives you need. So that solid state one goes up to 425 megabytes per second.
Oh, you can swap the drive. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's killer.
Yeah, so you could pretty much just like use it as a case and just, oh, that one's full, swap it out, put that in your, you know, in your kit. And it, that's what I thought was kind of neat. It wasn't like you had to buy a whole new setup, which is like a, well, I can't say a lot of what G-Tech does, but they have all kinds, all different kinds of stuff they have.
But, you know, these solid states are still up there too. Price, like, look at this, 1 terabyte for $900. That's... Yeah, but still, if you need that, that's 425 megabytes per second, solid state USB 3. So,
I tested that drive. It's a good drive. I have one. Actually, I took it through a car wash. I put it on the front of my car, and then everything was going fine. I put the link in the show notes.
Oh,
on,
okay,
you know, everything's going fine, and then the dryer came by, and it had so much wind, it took the drive and it threw it against a brick wall. And then dumped it in water, and all my data was still on there. So it's,
and it worked.
Oh,
you just plugged it in.
I still use it. Yeah. Now it's not a super fast drive, and also, you know, so let's say for 4K video, I wouldn't go there with it. But to 1080p, it's fine. RAW JPEG, of course, is good. Now the one thing is to, so you know, if you are using any of the drives you're using, whether it's USB 3 or you're using the Thunderbolt case. The drive, because the drive itself is a USB 3 drive, it's you're limited to SATA speeds.
Okay, so there's the bottleneck right there.
Yeah, you're not really going to get Thunderbolt 2 speed, but it's nice. Like if you have on a MacBook Pro, if you have your USB ports occupied, having the option of using a Thunderbolt port is quite nice.
No, for me, that was when I was looking at it, that was the one thing I noticed when I was talking to G-Tech at WPPI was. You know, I asked him, I go, well, for there's only $100 difference between the Thunderbolt one and the purely three USB version. And I said, well, isn't it just pretty much that you can use, you know, the Thunderbolt kind of wire on the case, but then when you open it up, that drive still uses a USB, like you were saying. And they're like, yeah. So it's just like you just said, it basically gives you that added option when you need it. And I know for me, I always have tons of crap plugged in. Like right now I have the Focusrite plugged in, and I have, you know, a Thunderbolt adapter to an Ethernet cable plugged in my laptop and stuff like that. So having the option is always nice.
Love it. Cool. Another good pick. Spending money. I'm actually in the market for a good portable drive. I think I have that. I have that drive that you alluded to previously. I don't think it's as rugged as this drive. And this seems like this would be the perfect drive for like the run around the world kit, know, where you want to be able to bang things up and plug, you know, just not baby your hardware. So cool, man. Thank you for that pick of the week. All right. My pick of the week, I know I'm going to take some flack over because this is a relatively old app. I think it's older, but it's cool. So this app is called Motion Portrait. And what it does is very simple. So you throw a headshot at it or a portrait, it will scan it, find the eyes, nose, mouth, etc., and then it animates it. It will make it look like the portrait comes alive and it starts moving its head and looking around the room. It is freaky. It's so accurate. If you give it a decent enough photo, it looks really realistic. So I threw a photo of the Mona Lisa at it. And it worked. You know, the Mona Lisa starts blinking and looking around the room. I'm like, holy crap. It really worked. So you can check it out. It's called Motion Portrait. I believe it's available for both Android and iOS. So, and it's not expensive. It's like $1 or something. But there's an article on, and this is an old article from last year, November of last year, from BuzzFeed, that they're kind of reviewing it and talking about how cool this app is. And if you're watching the video, you can see a picture of the Joker that they brought to life by just running it through app. It's really weird when you start running, like I was just going through my camera roll on the phone and finding pictures of friends and then sending them the animated version of themselves. Like, what the heck did you just
do? It's weird. It's
just
seeing the Joker. It's a drawing.
It is really weird.
Yeah,
you know what? And so my other pick, I have two picks. So it's Motion Portrait, and the other one is an app called Prisma. You guys may have heard of that. And it's like,
if you've logged on Facebook at all in the last 2 weeks, yeah.
Yeah, and that's how I found out about it. It's like everybody's, I'm like, how the heck did you do that? That's actually really cool. So what I did was I downloaded Prisma and created some portraits using the Prisma effects and then ran them through this app. So now you have these animated digital illustrations of people that are like, how the heck did you animate a sketch? You know? So I think that's part of the secret of doing cool stuff like this, is when you start stacking these apps and doing things that people weren't expecting. And then, you know, of course you tell a story with the whole thing. Don't just do it. But it's really, really cool what they did. It's almost scary because it takes like a second for it to take that photo and animate it. And I'm on something as relatively underpowered as a smartphone. And I'm thinking, like, okay, what if you had a supercomputer? What could you what could you do? What if you had this app running on your Mac, you know, your Mac Pro or something with serious horsepower? You know, it could get even more accurate. And so one of the cool things about the app, I think, is slightly unfinished, or maybe slightly more than slightly unfinished, is the fact that you can actually talk into your phone and the photo will talk in your voice and the mouth will move.
Oh,
in
hell
sync.
No. Oh, my God.
It will move in sync with what you say. And then you can hit a button. It'll record the video that you can then send to people.
Okay.
So, of course, I had Donald Trump talking. I had Barack Obama talking, you know. So you can, you know, with great power comes great responsibility.
That's wild. I'll have to definitely check it out. Yeah.
Yeah, check it out. It's called Motion Portrait, and the other one that we'll put in the show notes is called Prisma, if you haven't heard of that yet. Those are the two apps that have been annoying my friends and family for the last
If
month.
I can, so, there's one with a similar portrait name, and it was Live Portrait. Have you guys heard of it?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I love Live Portrait. And I wanted to actually use Live Portrait with this technique. So animate a portrait and then use Live Portrait to bring that portrait to life. So explain what Live Portrait is.
Yeah, so same thing. When I was at WPPI this past year, I met Alex Quaresma, who's been on the show, and he was telling me about Live Portrait, and he was really smart. He went there purely just to network. So he had copies of these books he made. I think they're by Bay Photo Lab. He'll mm-hmm. correct me, but that were little books, and they were of these two big projects he did. So one was with the job he did for the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team. Mm-hmm. So this is before they actually, you know, won the whole thing. And the other one was for HBO, where it was portraits of Floyd Mayweather and Manny Pacquiao. And essentially, you almost like a QR code scanner, you would basically, you could float your phone over this portrait. And using the app, you would suddenly transform the entire book or whatever surface you had it on, that would basically show a behind-the-scenes video of how the portrait was taken. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine if you're networking with people and they're looking and seeing, like, oh my God, how did you do that with this? Because like his shoot with the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team was really cool. It had like almost like pops of colored powder going through the photo.
Right.
So that obviously is a very big conversation starter when you see the photo and you go, oh my God, how'd you do that? And he goes, well, check it out. And it was really, I think what was really neat, I had a video of it when he was showing it to us. And what was cool was, even when you turned it, like within like the book that you were seeing on your phone, even when you turned it, the whole picture turned with it.
Yeah, it tracks. So it tracks
and
maps
really smoothly. And
yeah,
it was
VR.
Blown away.
Yeah, what I did, I did some experiments with that when I first learned about those guys. It might have been at that same trade show. I think based on Julio's influence, I was playing with a lot of Flixel-type animated portraits at the time. And what I did was I created an animated portrait with music and sound and stuff in the background. It was like a girl pouring tea or something. And then I made a print of it, hung it on the wall, and did a live portrait from it. So when you looked at it, normally it's like, oh, nice picture of a girl, you know, pouring tea. You look at it through your phone, and suddenly it came to life with the sound and her actually pouring tea, and it was mapped into the exact frame on the wall. It just, you know, it was like serious Harry Potter magic stuff going on.
Do you guys have the app on your phone, the live portrait app?
Yes, I do.
Cool. Scan. I'm going to put an image up on the screen. Scan that.
All right. Wait. Let me bring it up large here. All right. There it is. It's live. Let me bring it up.
Tell me. My phone's upstairs. But you can.
Wait. I'm going to try it here. Live portrait. All right, G. You're live here. Let's see if it works. Scanning. Oh, look at that. Look at that. G made a commercial. That's awesome. So this photo that we're showing on the screen, you guys can't see my phone, but the photo that you're seeing that you were seeing was a poster that G shot. It looked like a great promotional poster. When I looked at it through live portrait, the soundtrack started and all the kids started moving around and giggling and all that stuff. So that's, I think it's live portrait is a really cool way to bring the digital motion world into the still world, so that people that are like, you know, these swear by their prints. Like, gee, you remember that? Remember that argument you had with that woman at that one trade show?
Oh yeah, dude, I thought print. She was gonna kick my ass.
She was. Gee basically told her that, yeah, your entire industry is over. Sorry.
People love hearing that.
It does. Yeah. It does breathe new life though into prints. And a cool thing is like with the Summer Lunch Buddies is we did an English version and a Spanish version, and then they could swap out the content by keeping the posters the same. So those posters are going to be in schools, YMCAs. It was a shoot for the Department of Health to educate children and children's parents on mainly, hey, there's money available for lunch in the summer for kids and a safe place to hang out. You know, and kids always have a smartphone on them, but they don't really pay attention to stuff that's printed up. So now with this, they can scan it, and then it could change, and they can have all sorts of cool stuff. And
it's brilliant.
There was magnets mailed out and stuff passed out at schools, and so it's been pretty successful.
I think it's really cool. I mean, it has a lot of possibility. A for like what you did, you know, those kind of commercial applications for high end fine art gallery installations. Mm-hmm. You know, showing like I could see like fine art motion portraits and those sorts of things where you're walking through a gallery and everyone sort of looks at the image through their phone and boom, it comes to life. Or even in the future when people have VR goggles and they can kind of look around and kind of see this animated art on the wall. All that stuff is here today. They built it. One of the markets that they're going after, the live portrait guys they are going after, is the yearbook market, as you'll see if you go to their website. Where you open, imagine your school yearbook where you can open it up instead of just saying, yeah, I kind of remember that kid. You know, you aim your phone at it, and now that kid comes to life and he's like, hey, yeah, I used to beat up Jose every day in the playground. I'm still going to get you, man.
Right, right.
You know, now you're like 30 years later, you're like, oh, I remember that kid. I got to go crush him. You know,
almost like Freddy Krueger-esque, you know, when he used to come out of your dream sequence and kind of come alive. I think it's neat because, like you said, it's just literally taking like little cinegraphs. Remember those when they were real popular?
Mm-hmm.
And it was just that one tiny element that was moving in a still photo, and it kind of freaked you out.
Yeah.
And it's just taking that to the next level. And I think that's really neat.
Julio laughs because he's like, yeah, I remember when those were popular. I love it. Cool. Julio, you got to give us the link to that photo so that people can see it and scan it.
Oh, yeah, I'll send it to you so you can put it in with the show notes.
Yeah, just pop it in the show notes. I left a little place in there for you.
Okay,
just
cool.
Pop it in there when you get a second. Cool. All right, guys, we are at the end of the show. Before we close things out, G, what do you got coming up, man? What are you working on?
Where is my stuff? Because I forgot already. So I shot this cool, it's an art piece. It's about a minute long called Presence, and it's basically about a guy, a man and a woman who become present to each other, and just it's a representation of how we're not really present to each other at all. And when we are, we get disrupted and uncomfortable, and the emotions they go through. It'll be pretty rad. It's shot in 4K, so it's gonna, you know, it's got some really crazy music. I got music licensed by Moby for it, so it's wow. it's a pretty. You got to see it. When you see it in 4K, though, it'll blow your mind. It's really cool, and all the black and white work's all done in camera. It's all meant to look kind of retro.
That's cool. So, hey, that looks like that woman looks familiar. Have I met her?
Yeah, she does a lot of work at the trade shows for Panasonic and Sigma and stuff.
Very cool. Very cool.
Right. Shot minimally, one lens, one camera.
Nice. What camera did you shoot this?
That's
with
the GX8.
GX8.
Yeah.
Look at that. What lens?
The Nocticron.
The 42.5.
Yeah. The 1.2.
Yeah. What other lens is there?
Yeah. Yeah. And I shot that. I shot that at 1.2.
Nice. I love it.
So
cool.
Yeah. So that I'm, you know, working on Creator's Path podcast, which is becoming a representation of the new standard of photography. So like I interviewed. Everybody I've interviewed on their photographers, but we talk about more the creative process and what else are they doing besides photography that is influencing their business. For instance, I just interviewed Monica Ullman, who is the producer for H&M, producer for like the first Diesel catalog in the States. She did the Madonna sex book in the 90s. That's me and Jeff Newton, who does a lot of really cool covers based in LA, and we talked about the paradox of choice in photography. So it's kind of an intellectual conversation on photography and really about the struggles and the successes that everyday working photographers have. So these are not necessarily people that you would see doing big trade shows, but these are like everyday working pros you may not know about but are doing stuff on the high end and how they do it.
I love it.
And they're sharing the real deep stuff.
So it's the real photographers that are not that people that are doing trade shows aren't real photographers, but these are photographers that aren't necessarily working the circuit and, right. and are the celebrities. They're like they're in the trenches making great images, going home, eating dinner, come back the next morning, back in the trenches making great images.
Yeah, struggling with bidding, you know, dealing with all that stuff, marketing, trying to keep up with technology, and you know, feeling the stress of like, do they have to be on social media? Does it matter? You know, and in the meantime, they're shooting all these really cool assignments and doing all this really cool stuff, and it's stuff that you may not know their face, but you've seen the work.
Yeah.
So
that's cool.
Thanks.
That's cool, man. How's that going? When did you launch that show?
I think I launched that in October, I think.
Okay.
And it's
same time as I launched my show.
Yeah, maybe a little after, I forgot, but it's going pretty good. I actually launched it initially for self therapy because I was going through like a creative crisis.
Yeah.
And it's becoming its own thing. So it's the knowledge that people will share is amazing. Like I interviewed Mary Beth Coeth, I always forget, I mess up her last name, but she ran over 800 miles with this guy up and down Miami Beach, and he is a country singer, and she did a whole documentary on him, got kickstarted for $30,000, and now she's got a movie out on him. I mean, jeez. And she talks about the whole process and how she did covers for Southwest Magazine, and you know, and then she was just in Petapixel a couple days ago about the series she did on off-duty Santa Clauses, like what do the Santa Claus guys do when they're not
I
Santa
saw
Claus?
That. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, so it's like it's a really cool way to connect with photographers you may not have normally have heard about.
Love it. Cool, man. So, and you refreshed julioshorio.com.
Yeah,
well,
I went through my old stuff and some of my new stuff, and I reformulated my portfolio, and I mean it's all commercial work and like portfolio for the most part, and I'm still.
Hey, you're a real photographer.
Yeah. Hey. So
cool, man. Well, congratulations. Thanks. It sounds like you got a lot of cool stuff going on professionally and personally. It's going to be a big year for you.
I hope so, man, because it's a strange one.
Yeah. Well, don't worry about it, man. It gets stranger from here. It's all good. Awesome. Well, cool, man. Thanks for coming on the
Thank
show
you.
Again. I appreciate it. All right, Jose Rosado, man. What do you have coming up?
So yeah, so we're actually going to be coming up in the next week or two on our 100th episode of the Angry Millennial Show. So
let me bring that
up. Yeah. So it's kind of wild, and we hit it. We're probably going to be hitting it at about the 9 or 10 month mark. So it's been, as you can imagine, been plugging along since we started it in October last year. And I think kind of like what you two were alluding to was when it came, when I had the idea for the podcast and that sort of thing, it came at a time when I definitely needed it. And I think that after the 100th episode, we're going to kind of switch gears a little bit. And I'm going to announce that after the 100th episode of what that might is going to be. But one of the things, and we talked about it last time, that I'm going to be concentrating on is Creatives Against Depression. Mm-hmm. So,
oh, yeah.
So I kind of, it's like an endeavor that I've kind of brought on that basically was a way to kind of help stimulate conversation about mental health. And so if you go to creativesagainstdepression.com, you'll see, you know, there's a blog with different articles, whether it's stuff we kind of find around the internet that are helpful or even stories from creatives themselves, you know, some well-known people, others who G mentions kind of are the people who no one really knows about, but at the same time, they are making great work and they have had the same struggles that a lot of us do. So I'm going to be doing more with that, hopefully doing some speaking and some more events and that kind of stuff, and hopefully a mention in a big magazine that I can't talk about yet, but in the fall will be coming out. And then the other things are I'm working on an ebook. So because of the show, like most things, you do it for long enough, I started thinking that maybe giving some kind of content back would be neat. So I'm going to do an ebook on creating deep and meaningful interviews. Mm-hmm. And along with that, just doing more podcast consulting work.
Yeah, so, how's that going, yeah, by the way?
Going well. So it's been a lot of, like, in the beginning, it was I went straight after more bigger for-profit companies and nonprofits, which I guess in my head made sense. But as you can imagine, it was tougher to break into that because it's just a lot of bureaucratic red tape. So now switching gears a little bit and just helping other normal people get their show started.
Very cool, man. Look, see, you guys are like giving back. You make me feel bad. I'm not doing enough. I got to do more. You guys are inspiring me to do more. What can I do to give back and help? This is good. Well, thanks, Jose, both of you guys, for coming on. It's always inspiring to talk to both of you guys. And Jose, by the way, I feel like my mic, which I've used for the past like 150 episodes of TWIP, is jealous of your beautiful Shure mic. So I may have to switch gears. You and a Baryon X Perillo have that cool mic. I want that mic.
So I will say this. I love my Shure, right? It's great, but it's not cheap. Look at this. So this is what we use to record on the actual podcast.
Yeah.
It's what is actually
that? Well,
it's,
describe it for the audio listeners.
It's a Pile PD-78. It's basically a Shure SM57 knockoff. And what's crazy is the Shure version is $100 and this is $8 on Amazon.
What?
And
$8?
If you,
what?
And if you listen to the show.
What you talk about, Willis? $8?
I'm not even kidding you. It's really hard to distinguish a difference in sound from my Shure from this thing.
Is that USB or XLR?
It's an XLR.
What?
It's analog.
For $8?
Yeah.
It cannot be good for $8. I'm sorry.
So, I mean, I'm sure like a lot of us as photographers can attest, right? We've had the amazing, very expensive, high-end tier stuff, and then we've gone back to the basics and had kind of cheaper stuff that we loved and was able to use just as good. And that was kind of my thinking with the show when I started it. I was like, I could go after the bigger stuff a lot of people do, but it's like, you know, it's like buying a D5 your first year of shooting. It's kind of, you're
now,
gonna, it's
when you're doing your podcast consulting, which mic do you recommend to the new podcasters?
I actually go with the Audio Technica. Which one is it? The ATC. I'm blanking out, but it's really neat because this one, it's like $70. And what's cool is you mentioned if it's analog or USB, and this one's actually both. So it's really neat because I tell people.
Give me the link to that.
Yeah, I'm gonna try and pull it up in Amazon. But so basically, it on the bottom it has both a USB port and an XLR port. So what I tell people is it's great because in the beginning, if you just want to plug a microphone into your computer, you have it. And then later on, when you sit there and say, you know, I want to get a little bit more serious and use like XLR cables and use an interface or anything like that, that then you can do that and you don't have to buy something new, you know, which I think
I'd want
really
that.
Neat.
I'd want that because I would use it on my desktop for these kind of situations. Mm-hmm. But then if I'm traveling, I'd want to, if, you know, granted, if it works, I'd like to be able to plug it into my, say, iPad and mm-hmm. record that way, you know, with the USB adapter.
Yep. So here we go. It's the Audio Technica ATR2100. And I'll send you the link.
ATR2100. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Send me that link. Audio Technica. Yeah. All right. Cool. I will recommend that to people and tell them that I came up with it. Thank you. Appreciate it.
No problem.
No. Cool, man. So I would be remiss not to say that my good buddy Tim Engel is the guy that turned me on to Motion Portrait. He wanted me to make sure that I let everyone know that I did not discover it, even though it's old. He discovered it. So Tim Engel discovered Motion Portrait and turned me onto it yesterday, and I've been, or a couple days ago, and I've been a fiend with that thing since. All right, guys, we're at the end of another episode of This Week in Photo. Be sure to visit us and our new TWIP school at twipschool.com. You can check out our website at thisweekinphoto.com. You can subscribe to our other fantastic shows, including titles like Street Focus and The Fix and All About the Gear and Alpha Mirrorless and on and on and on. And of course, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. And if you're watching us on YouTube, please be sure to comment, like, and subscribe. And with that, it's time to take that lens cap off.
This Week in Photo is a PixelCore.tv production, produced by Suzanne Llewellyn, with technical producers John Riley and Alutha Jamakar.